Yeah.
Yes. Scott King interview, July 22, 1987, taped 2, side A.
In tackling issues, for example, say like overhead fixed fee that had ramifications for the overall financial health of the organization, are these things you were able to decide on your own? Did you discuss them with the director's office? How did that relationship?
The president, work? Yeah, he became president.
Right.
Oh, sure, if there's going to be any, this big 4.6 change, that was thoroughly discussed. But I had pretty much discretion, but not in the area of that much of a change of fee, because that represented quite a few bucks. And also, it tends to become a precedent for other clients. And we had other clients at that point. So you're talking about some money. So it's really a top policy decision as to whether we should make a tremendous issue out of it or go along with it. So, but overhead and all that sort of stuff, that was all up to me. Overhead is pretty much cut and dried. And there are certain unallowable costs in there that I had the authority to agree to. If it didn't involve, didn't have policy implications. I certainly wouldn't make a decision on what the salary of the president should be, or the trustees and directors, or fees, or any of that sort of stuff, without, because that affects outside people, which reflects on the corporation.
On the trustees, did you, just what was their impact on your work? One of the things that trustees do is to sort of at least in general bless the overall operation of an organization.
Right.
So they're presented with, you know, pictures of the health of it and everything. Were they active?
Well, let me tell you, the first meeting we had in November of 1948, the first meeting of the board of directors, board of trustees. I don't know whether I suggested, I rather think I did. I held the floor for 45 minutes to half to an hour, explaining exactly what I'd done on the accounting system and who reviewed it, like the auditors and the CPAs and approved it and so on. And what I'd done on this and that and the other, went through the whole thing with them. My obvious purpose there is to get off on the right foot so they know what the hell we're doing at the earliest possible moment. Pardon me. And so that went over real well, and then I think that I engendered some confidence in them as to what we had done preparatory to going nonprofit. So they were relaxed. Now, after that, I had very little substantive contact with the board as far as, but I did in the sense that I talked to the finance committee about what we ought to do with excess cash, whether we go into CDs or war bonds or whatever. And the biggest contact I had with them was, I guess, on their expense accounts, is there any questions they had or so on and so forth. But that's the only areas I can think of was the investment area. They're more interested in the substantive work of a corporation, although not all of them by any means are scientists as time went along. I would say most of them were, but not all.
Uh, I guess sort of expanding my earlier question, what generally was the character of your relationship with the president's office? Did you have, for example, regular meetings, regular reporting? How did that work?
No, he and I never had regular meetings. We did have management meetings, weekly management meetings, which of course I sat in on with the department heads and Goldie and Frank. And any question that came up at my bailiwick, of course, I'd answer. If I had something to say that I thought should be corrected, the department heads were going off the wrong way, or they weren't signing their time cards or something that's trivial but important to the auditors, I'd speak up. And then if I went back east on a procurement trip or something, I would talk to Frank and Goldie and say, I think the following areas may be up for discussion with the PCO on this, and my feeling on this is that, and that is this, and this is that, and what do you think? And they'd say, okay, or let's not do that, or, you know, we'd bat it around a little bit. But we had no formal meetings. Frank was really basically interested in the work, the substantive work, and he read most of the major reports. No, he did. We went out. And, well, I'm glad you're going to talk to Frank. That's fine. You going down the desert and see him?
Yes.
Uh-huh. That'll be pleasant. If you don't hit 112. He's quite deaf, I might add. But,
yes, we've heard that he's had a hearing problem.
As long as I know.
What was the character of these management meetings that you mentioned, weekly management meetings?
Well, depending on the timing, if a board meeting were coming up, they'd go over the briefings and who was going to give them and so on. Talking just about everything, about the status of a building annex that's going up, and or a new fringe benefit that's coming in, or personnel changes. That was a big thing. I'm trying to get a hold of John Smith from the University of Pittsburgh, who's a top nuclear physicist. And I hope we can get him, then we'll use him this way, and that sort of thing. It's quite a cross-section because you got the department heads in there who are interested in personnel procurement, as I mentioned, and their substantive work, and a little bit of everything comes in. Why don't we increase the per diem for travel?
But they weren't primarily forums for discussion substantive research activity?
No, they were not. They were not. They. I think at one time we had a research council who did that. I was not involved in that at all.
So basically, your relationship to the department or division heads was along the lines of the things discussed in this management committee relating to various aspects of procurement.
One of the things that I got into at one point was, I was in charge, if you can use that phrase, of fringe benefits. That was one of my areas, retirement plan and so on. And I would get quite a few complaints, suggestions about why don't we do this and why don't we do that, and let's get rid of that retirement plan. A friend of mine is with Provident Mutual, they have a dandy one and all this sort of thing. Why don't we increase the life insurance limits? That's one of the things that be in touch with it. Or one of my people had an accident and the insurance company wouldn't cover him for hospital. Why is that? And then I have to get into that. Later on, the personnel department took over that. But I was basically in charge of reviewing potential new benefits and implementing them. In other words, signing a contract, if you will, although you don't sign contracts, no. But then the personnel department will take over the administration of it. They take the complaints about Susie Jones is pregnant, and what does she get, and all that sort of stuff.
For something like fringe benefits, is this the kind of thing that, that came out of your 6%, or is it something that got fed back into the labor cost?
Very few things are unallowable, really. If, that's the way we wanted to keep them, because we didn't want to waste money. Unallowable are such things as entertainment, interest on borrowings. That's what I want to think about, man, unless you make an extravagant expenditure. For example, if you, well, I think I was going to say that for the 25th anniversary of RAND, we had a shindig, but I think that was allowable, at least in part. In other words, that's something normal commercial practice.
There's a lot is made of the research environment at RAND,
mm-hmm.
as a congenial place for people to work and to do research, because they have a great deal of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever consciously trying to make the procedures, paperwork burden, and the administrative approval burden for all of these various things that, that have to be done in the course of ordinary employment? Was that a conscious goal of yours?
I mean, to make it as easy,
to make it as, easy
yeah.
as possible on the research
yes, it was.
Staff?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. That was just one of our early tenets. Keep all this stuff away from the thinkers, you know, and you handle it. And that's fine. That was what my job was. Very seldom ever have to bother anybody. Most of the way it happens, they come to me on some problem, which of course I try to handle.
They wanted to travel. They wanted to travel right away,
But I would never go to the department head and say, "You guys aren't signing your time cards" or something like that. I'd handle it in a different way. Of course, they had administrative assistants and so on, which I'd work through. And, but that was the tenant around here, you know, just leave them alone. Just not bother them with all this damn paperwork. And then I'd have to try to balance the scale a little bit and say, yeah, but we do need certainly a modicum or a minimum to satisfy the auditors that such and such did happen.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things I don't know if you're familiar with it, but when auditors go into a contractor's plant, for example, Douglas, they have what they call a floor check. They have a proverbial clipboard. They go up to you and say, "Joe, what are you working on right now?" And you'd say, "Well, I'm working on the outer wings of the DC-6. So then he'd pull your time card from the most recent period, and if it said something entirely different, you say, "Well, this doesn't match what you tell me and what this time card said." In other words, it's a floor check. It's just that simple. Well, they tried that just once at RAND, and we got their butt out of here. So imagine going up to a guy's trying to figure out how to get this satellite going around. What did you work on last week? So anyway, that sort of thing we made damn clear is not going to happen around here, that kind of audit.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, in the sense that you have the research staff in departments and divisions, but you have projects that are matrixed across these lines. And so somebody, to a researcher, their life is an uninterrupted flow of working and thinking. And they're not inclined, in most cases, to keep any sort of detailed time log as to how much of their time they've spent thinking about this problem or that problem. Yet, at some point, you have to bill where you have to, account for this.
I was thinking of the old days, what you just said would apply to the old days, just sit and think, because we had Project Rand, and we had a handful of people working on AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, and that was it. But nowadays, of course, we have multiplicity of efforts, and we have to keep pretty sharp time records.
When did that change? That is, when did that, when did you first really start having to worry about bill numbers and things like that?
Well, we had to not worry about it, even with the AEC, you had to distinguish between AEC and Project Rand. But I would say when we took some OSD work, as I mentioned, 1959, that was a what you might call a substantial contract in dollars. So you had to keep pretty careful records, and also it's the same type of work. Same, you know, it's a, so a guy could work on one and then the other if his skill was required. So I would say, yeah, about 1959, 1960, we had keep pretty careful time records. I think as a practical matter, I shouldn't say.
For the Air Force work, say during the 50s, which was fairly monolithic, right. Was the yearly Air Force contract broken down into sort of smaller work package units? I mean, you've got a these various divisions, and they're all working on different kinds of problems. They have to be very careful about billing their work to a certain part of the contract,
no.
Or was it just
no.
It was just
the contract still reads the same today as it did in 46. Just stay within this 5-line parameter. So billing, all you have to do is put down the master work order. You don't have to put down the sub-project or anything like that. Now.
So interdisciplinary kind of interactions
right.
was not a problem during the 50s
no,
in a billing
right.
sense.
That's right. So I'm trying to think of nowadays, and I just don't know whether they keep project accounting or not. I just don't know.
Another problem that sort of a potential problem that comes to mind in terms of protecting the research environment is the question of Rand had a gradual increase in personnel
right.
over time.
Right.
Did this greater burden in handling the activities of a larger number of people affect your ability to maintain this environment from the treasurer's perspective?
Well, I guess so, just from the sheer numbers, but I can't say it was ever a real burden, ever a real problem, let's put it that way.
It's just more traffic through the existing
yeah.
structures and the existing
yeah.
mechanisms,
yeah.
but you didn't have to innovate, invent anything for... To go from one size to
no,
another.
Not really.
That is, you could grow your systems.
They grow within
could
the structure.
Mm-hmm. Did you find any use in your own area of management within the corporation for some of the logistical innovations that were coming out of the research departments? That is, they were doing some really interesting things to help Air Force logistics, large complicated systems. Was that just, were those sorts of things just inappropriate for the job
yeah,
you
I know,
had to
yeah,
do?
Yeah, that's right. I think there's kind of hitting a fly with a sledgehammer. You know, we just didn't need it.
Just traditional standard
yeah, there was
management techniques
yeah,
and structures
right, right.
were
yeah.
entirely adequate. Do you ever compare notes with other nonprofits, with
oh, sure.
treasurers at other
sure,
organizations,
sure.
and especially as these other ones began
right.
to spin off
but
from Rand?
They, as you can imagine, most of them came to us to ask questions as they were getting set up. And, you know, how did you do it, and how do you do it now, and what happens if we do this, and so on. Oh yes, we were know them all very well. We always visited when we were in town, so.
How did you, I know that Crawford Thompson worked for you for a number of years. How did your office operate? What responsibilities did he have in relation to your activity? How did that work?
Well, we didn't really have that clear-cut separation. I would say he was mostly in the accounting side of it. He worked quite a bit on fringe benefits and so on, administration of fringe benefits. There's only two of us, so it's pretty hard to say, you do this and I'll do that. I did most of the negotiation. Well, I did all of it, actually. And travel and that sort of thing.
And then I assume you just had some kind of secretarial staff or in addition to that?
I had two girls.
Yeah.
And Robert and myself. And then an accountant and the county staff of six or eight or whatever. And travel was under me. I had a travel office of four or five people. An awful lot of travel in this organization. Really staggering. I think at the time I left, our airline travel alone was $2 million. That's just the airline bill, not the hotel or any other. Really a big travel operation. Well, it has to be. It's an outfit that's thinking and trading thoughts with other people, so you can't be in a vacuum. You have to.
So you mentioned that you handled the negotiations. When the yearly reconsideration came around about how much the Air Force was going to provide, that was essentially your bailiwick to work with them and
right.
arrive at a figure.
And the other clients too, OSD, and as they came along.
Right. I wonder, in the early 50s, I know that, you know, the Air Force had some difficulties in providing all the money that Rand felt it needed. They had appropriations were cut back for this in Congress. What was your role in the face of this potential diminishment of their financial commitment?
Well, there's not much you can do about that. I had no real active role. I meant to mention that when we started talking about diversification. Toward the, did you say the early 50s? I don't think, is that right?
I thought
it was the latter part of the 50s, and that's when General Pudd, who was our overseeing general at that point, he urged us to go out and get some other work. That helped us on this OSD thing. Because they were cutting back, but I thought it was later than that. Well, you have the dates at your fingertips.
49, or even as early as 49, there was some hiccups in the Air Force budget, and there were some cuts proposed in the Rand contract, to which Rand seemed to have responded with some notion that they go after Navy funding, and then the Air Force came back with a
49 sounds like a wrong year, because it seems to me we still had quite a big piece of the $10 million left in 49. I think we ran out of that in maybe 50 or halfway into 51. But we did look for diversification all the way along, and we're trying to keep the nest warm in case we had to jump that way. But that's an important point, that one about General Putt suggesting, you can't lose these peoples, and it's silly. So diversify, go out and get some other support. So when the Air Force General says that, it's pretty hard for the Air Force to whimper and whine about our diversity.
Did your office have any special role as these spin-offs, SDC and
I'll say.
What was your...
It was me in particular. Taking SDC first, and then you know about ANSWER later.
Right.
First of all, I hired the treasurer of SDC, and we went through a second exercise of setting up a nonprofit, which we'd done for RAND with all the accounting and all that business. And on Tuesday morning of every week for about 6 months, we had management breakfast consisting of me and Steve Jeffries. Are you going to talk to Steve, by the way?
We haven't scheduled to, but we're well aware.
Yeah, he just got out of the hospital, so it may be a while. Steve handled the administrative end, just in general terms, and I handled the financial end. Steve and I and Goldie, and then their counterparts, the president of SDC and the treasurer, Jim Berkson, who I hired, we all met for breakfast and went over the problems that the SDC was having. And then again, we had to do the same thing on assignment of documents. See, RAND had the leases on the buildings there on Colorado Boulevard. So we had to sign that over to SDC as a corporation. And all the other documents, leases and rentals and contracts and subcontracts and consultants agreements and so on. So we were very intimately involved in both setting them up and then overseeing them for 6 months or whatever and helping them with any problems they had.
I'm a little unclear from the record. I know the core group of people that became SDC, there was some negotiation, it was 53-54 or something, when the Air Force wanted RAND to take on this systems activity.
Right.
What I wasn't clear on whether the Air Force gave RAND an additional amount of money to do this work or whether it was incorporated into its general yearly allotment. Do you recall?
I'm sure. I don't quite understand your question. You mean, did S... Well, let me start, and then you fill in and ask a question.
Okay.
We started off with the Air Defense Command, which is the client, the Colorado Springs, for SD, let's call it SDC work. At that point, it was RAND work, of course. So we got a contract, and it was actually a simulation model of an air defense exercise. Before this came along, the way the Air Defense Command would train its people, as they call them, controllers, was that the Strategic Air Command would fly overhead and the Air Defense Command would fly after them. Then they'd all estimate how many planes were shot down or how many worms, which is a pretty dumb way to do it. So anyway, our people developed a simulation model on the computer where you could actually run through an exercise and you could see the planes on the screen and one thing or another. And then at the very end, the computer would compute how many kills there were and all the detail. So you really knew what the hell you did. So we were training these guys from all the air defense stations all throughout the country. So to make a long story short, RAND at that point, excluding the SDC work, was, if memory serves me, like $15 million. And the SDC thing grew to be $19 million. And not only were we training them, but we were also producing the programs, the software, the books, the hard copy, one thing or another. Well, two things led us to believe that this wasn't for us. First of all, this is not research. The research had been done long since when the original notion was proved and tested. And secondly, it was like the kid eating the father. It was just getting too big, and it was too diverting to management and everything else to continue on. So we suggested to the Air Defense Command, which they bought, that it be spun off as SDC. It was a discrete division here, it was SDD, System Development Division of RAND Corporation, and all those people went to SDC, new corporation.
But the Systems Development Division was established through a separate contract apart from
yes.
your
Air
normal
Defense,
Air
right.
Force.
Air Defense Command money, right. So they went on and later became a profit corporation, later bought by Burroughs.
Let's see. Were there any, we talked about it briefly, but about the organization charts. Do you recall any extensive reorganizations before this matrix implementation in the late 60s?
No, not really. I would guess that we may have combined some technical divisions or renamed them or something of that sort, but nothing that was earth-shaking until the matrix thing came along. And you understand all about that, I guess. I could expound on that. But
well, it might be interesting just to
explain
what happened, in
say,
context.
This multidisciplinary effort and characteristic of RAND was fine when we were small because of that poor among the department heads. At that time, of course, as you can tell from the chart, they were divided into skills and areas. And if a man needed another man to work on a project RAND, he'd go to the department and say, hey, I need a mathematician or whatever. But then it just became too tough a thing with the diversification for the department heads to really serve all these different contracts. So it became clear that we needed the matrix system, which vertically one guy, a project leader or a director or whatever the hell they call them nowadays, would have the project RAND thing, and it'd be his responsibility to go to the department heads, say, I want him and I want him and I want him because I got this sub-project under project RAND that needs attention. And then you ask yourself, what happens to the department heads at this point? Well, the department heads are basically responsible for the acquisition of personnel and personnel administration of their people, and of course deeply involved in the assignment of their people as to who's the best mathematician you got and one thing and another, and salary reviews and all that. So there was some concern as to what would happen with the department head. I was concerned about it because up to the matrix went in, what, 69, something like that, late 60s. But up to that point, the department heads had been king of the walk. You know, I mean, there's 5, 6, 7 of them, or it wasn't. They ran the show as far as their people were concerned. But now, a stranger's introducing himself and saying, give me that, and give me this, and give me this. And so. But it worked out fine, as far as I can see. It sure made a lot of sense, because you do need somebody to head an effort, not just had a bunch of people. But to answer your question, I don't remember anything before that was really earth-shaking.
I guess one reference I have is apparently in 1956, several of the departments were merged, aeronautics, electronics, geophysics, and something called operations. Do you recall that?
I don't recall operations or geophysics at all. Were they departments?
I think small ones, yeah.
You mean physics, not geophysics?
Perhaps it was just physics.
Physics departments, right. Physics department was the old nuclear energy department. Say it again, would you?
that in 1956, these several departments were merged, apparently just incorporated probably into an engineering department at that time.
Yeah, right. That's right. We had aircraft and missiles at one time, all those into engineering, combined with engineering. And the physics was combined with something?
It was also put in under the engineering auspices, I believe, at that time. Well, I guess, judging from your action, it didn't have anything to do with fiscal operations. It was more obviously an intellectual kind of...
Yeah.
One of the, in talking with some of the other people who have been at RAND, there was a sense that everybody, whether it was the person who delivered the coffee or people in other support functions, were a real part of the intellectual excitement that was going on here. Did you feel similarly that you were closely connected
to
this?
Yes, indeed, I did. It was a great spur too to assume the attitude of trying to help these people and doing everything, not being in the way of what they're trying to do, but to help them and minimize their diversion of effort and thought and so on. Yes, I think everybody at RAND was very excited about the whole concept of RAND and what RAND's done, and we've gotten quite a few kudos from our clients, the Air Force principally, and that makes you feel good that you're really getting somewhere. So I think the excitement pervaded the whole organization. Frank and Goldie were excellent leaders and very thoughtful and very thoughtful with the people. I mean, they bent over backwards for the staff.
Also, very early on in the 50s, RAND began to establish these branch offices, Washington,
Dayton,
overseas as well. Did that create any special problems for your area?
No.
Or did they?
We set up separate overheads for them because they had special problems, of course. I mean, so we had Dayton and Washington, and then intermittently overseas, right? We had Wiesbaden. No, that was no problem. It's just simple accounting.
Well, I'm sort of working down to the end of my questions, Joe. Do you have anything that's
I think I've got. I've asked the key questions that I wanted to ask. We always like to leave a little bit of time for you to ask yourself some questions, or to just
volunteer
freely
say
what you think that we've missed or what you think we ought to look at to get a better picture. See, you've made some notes.
Yeah, I went over your letter on your lap there. Oh, the New York City RANDS Institute, you didn't ask anything about.
Okay.
Did you run into that?
Actually, yeah. I'm not. I've only heard mention of it. I really don't know anything about it, when it was established or what its purpose was.
Well, that was set up in the late 60s. Let me just finish here and I can put this down.
Sure.
Okay. Mary Lindsay, John Lindsay, forget what the Rand contact was, but he knew he was very friendly with somebody in our organization. And he thought it'd be a well of an idea if Rand could set up an office in New York and undertake some cost-benefit, call what you will, research analysis study. I'm going to have to stand up for a minute. I got a replaced knee last 8 weeks ago, and if I don't move, it's going to kill me. So he suggested that we go and set up a research staff in New York City and work on some of their problems, such problems as the police department, the fire department, the social services department, budgetary practices, and so on in the city. So we agreed to do that and went back there. And as you can imagine, Rand going into that atmosphere in New York, telling fire chiefs and the fire commissioner that they ought to change all their firehouses around because they were set up in 1875 when the demand for services had demographically moved, you know, and the police department and so on. So we did some very good work back there. But then when Lindsay left, they got a new mayor, and I've forgotten his name. But he was rather unfriendly to Rand. In fact, he was sniping at Lindsay that the funds Lindsay used to fund Rand were improper and out of the wrong pot and didn't go through the Board of Estimate like it should have and all this. In other words, he's really sniping. So at one time, Rand had, if memory serves me, $6 million tied up in receivables there, which were kind of teetery because of this charge that this, he was controller at the time before he was married, that this controller made. But anyway, we worked our way out of that. And that was the New York City Rand Institute, which ran, and I ran weekend dates again, but I think it was probably like 50 or 68 to 72, something like that. But that was quite an experiment.
And was wholly funded by appropriations from the city.
Right. That's the only thing I have in my notes that we hadn't talked about.
Okay. I guess a couple more things popped to mind. One, to backtrack a little bit about the subcontracting. How did Rand go about selecting these subcontractors during the very early period? Was it did you establish some kind of formal review process, or was it simply kind of informal connections at that point?
I think it was informal connections with our senior guys here who knew of the work that ABC was doing, Collins Radio or Westinghouse, or whatever you want to, which one you want to pick. And then they go into discussions with them and say, we need such and such a study. And so the guy from the subcontractor or potential subcontractor would say, well, the way I'd approach this is so-and-so and so-and-so, so that sounds good to us, why we let a contract. There wasn't any formal bidding process or that sort of thing. Because most of the stuff is so far out that there are very few people that could do it, really, and weren't that up to speed.
Were you involved in the decision-making process that discontinued this activity? Because it, you know, in a fairly short order, Rand ceased doing subcontracting out aspects of the Air Force work. It was primarily brought in.
No, I can't say claim any influence on that decision. I think it was simply clear to the senior guys in the organization and to the president that just wasn't the economic way to do it. It didn't, apparently, from their technical judgment, it didn't really produce much sufficient results to warrant this expenditure fund.
The last question I guess I have is again sort of an understanding of whether one needs to establish slightly different systems or procedures for the costing out of classified work versus unclassified work? Is there any difference in how you have to, it's all put into the same system?
It's just people, you know, it's man hours and man years, whatever, with the applicable overhead, so security classification of the work, we have no, no bearing on that.
Perhaps as a conclusion, your sort of perception of your time at Rand and a kind of sense of what it meant to you
Well, I found it very rewarding in a broad sense. I think Rand did and is doing marvelous work in the field of security, and now, of course, we haven't even touched on that, the so-called domestic programs. And the diversification of experience that I got in finance and setting up systems and negotiating and meeting people in high-end government and all of this was a broad, to me, a broad mixture of experience that it'd be pretty hard to get in an average job, certainly. And also the people, I'm sure you've looked at our board of trustees. I don't think there's a board in the world as good. I'm getting emotional. There's a board in the world as good as ours. My God, the names on the boards is just fantastic, and I got to know them all reasonably well. You know, Walter Wriston, how many people know Wriston and argue with him about over a drink, argue with him about entering into California and interstate banking and all this.